This is John Ivey from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you articles from the April 12th edition of Sports Illustrated. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Our first article is entitled, Tough as They Come, and it features the NC2A National Champions Duke Blue Devils. Led by a rejuvenated coach and embracing a bruising brand of play, Duke seeds its fourth national title in Indianapolis, but only after resilient Butler gave the Blue Devils all they could handle in a breathtaking final. They were portrayed as just not good enough in recent years when measured against the towering success of their program over the last two decades. And then on the final night of Duke's unexpected climb to the national championship, suddenly the Blue Devils were too good, cast in a Final Four morality play as blue-blooded giants to beat up on a fresh-faced underdog newcomer playing in its home city before an adoring throng in a massive football stadium. It wasn't easy being Duke on one of the most remarkable Monday nights in the history of the NCAA tournament. When it was finished and the Nets were sheared from their rims in celebration of a riveting 61-59 victory over Butler in which neither team ever led by more than 6 points and every basket was earned like a long day's wage, Duke coach Mike Krzyzewski stood in front of his team in a small locker room in the belly of Lucas Oil Stadium in downtown Indianapolis. He held the game ball in his two sweaty hands, the championship trophy propped up nearby on a storage locker. It was his fourth title, tying Duke with arch-rival North Carolina for the most in the post-John Wooden era. All year long, I told you that you're a good team, he said to his players. Tonight, you're a great team. The Blue Devils became great because of the Bulldogs, who had won 25 straight games and become the first so-called mid-major to reach the championship in the 64-team era. Butler's story was sweet and tender. But his basketball was brutal and relentless, grounded in swarming half-court defense. We almost had an aura when we thought we were going to win every game, said Bulldogs coach Brad Stevens after Monday's final. They very nearly won this one. With 7 seconds to play and Duke clinging to a 60-59 lead, Butler's gifted 6'9" sophomore Gordon Hayward missed a fallaway 15-foot shot from the right baseline. Duke's 7'1" center senior, Brian Zubek, a central figure in his team's revival, clamped the rebound and was fouled with 3.6 seconds left. Zubek made the first free throw and then heard Krzyzewski tell him to miss the second. We figured with a rebound in possession, it would force them to shoot from half court, Coach K said later. Zubek threw the ball hard off the back rim. Hayward grabbed the rebound, pounded several dribbles to half court, getting a crushing and possibly illegal pick on Duke's Kyle Singler from Matt Howard, and heaved a 46-foot shot. Son of a gun looked good to me, said Singler. The shot traced a sublime arc as the clock froze zeros. The ball hit the glass and the rim and fell away. The crowd of 70,930, second largest for a championship game in tournament history, seemed to gasp as one. Duke players tumbled into piles in celebration. When it missed, this rush came over me, said Duke's senior forward Lance Thomas. Then John Shire tackled me. Duke's performance was emblematic of a team that finished 35-5 and won with toughness rather than style. Before the game, Krzyzewski wrote 4 words on a whiteboard in the locker room. Strong, together, talk, crash, as in the boards. It was the language of effort. The Blue Devils won not just because Hayward's last shot bounced away, but also because Singler, a junior wing who switched from power forward just this year as the team was transformed, was the one player whom Butler couldn't stymie. He scored a game-high 19 points and was named the Final Four's most outstanding player. We've developed and grown together, said Singler. This is going to last forever. Zubek, whose sophomore and junior season had been undone by foot injuries, played the final 9 minutes and 8 seconds with four fouls and grabbed the critical rebound off Hayward's first miss. Shire, so often criticized for Duke's shortcomings, battled Butler's defense and committed just two turnovers. Not many people can end their careers like this, even at Duke, Shire said after the game. To do it with these guys just feels incredible. And in a sweet piece of symmetry, Blue Devils junior guard Nolan Smith had 13 points and four assists in the same city where his late father Derek won the NC2A title with Louisville 30 years earlier. This means the world, Smith said, while standing on the floor with the piece of net tucked behind his left ear. I give this to my dad. There shows a picture, first on page 44, big picture with Gordon Hayward shooting that final shot and Nolan Smith just in front of him, and the clock showing 0:01. Then on page 46, shows Kyle Singler blocking a shot of a Butler player. The article continues. 3 days before the start of the Final Four, on a warm Wednesday night, the Blue Devils bus pulled out of the Indianapolis airport en route to their downtown headquarters. An old familiar hotel came into view. Krzyzewski doesn't embrace reminiscence. He is perpetually annoyed by words like since and never, expressions that shackle today's goals with yesterday's glory. But here he allowed himself a brief indulgence. That's where we stayed in 1991, he said to his wife, Mickey, who was sitting next to him. They remembered that. At the time, it seemed too far from downtown, too far from the celebration of the sport. And then the bus rolled on. That was the year Duke won its first national championship after four trips to the Final Four under Krzyzewski, an emotional title enabled by an upset of unbeaten UNLV in the national semifinals. For the Krzyzewskis, it seemed like yesterday, and it seemed like 100 years ago. On occasion, they are asked to reflect on all the wins, 868 of them, and all the championships and all the honors, and they find the weight of it almost paralyzing. When you put everything that's happened in a book and then just hand it to us, it's too much to take in. It doesn't seem real, says Mickey. It's almost like when somebody has $1 billion. I don't process $1 billion. Too many dollars. The players sitting behind them on the bus knew all about the symbolic bucket and the symbolic dollars and the singular history of Coach K's teams. Shire insists that he remembers Christian Laettner's epic shot against Kentucky in 1992, even though he was only four at the time. Smith was a Louisville fan until Jay Williams joined Duke in 1999. Thomas played Coach K's video game when he was a little kid. And if they didn't know enough about their place in the sport, they would be coldly reminded last Friday morning when the Indianapolis Star published a story headlined Despising Duke, purporting to detail a rampant dislike of the Duke Blue Devils program because of its successes and perceived smugness. The article included a picture of Krzyzewski that had been doctored in blue ink, with a bullseye in the middle of his forehead, among other defacements, as if it had been attacked by Duke-hating graffiti artists. In a press conference that same day, Krzyzewski called the photo juvenile, and the paper apologized for publishing it. Later, Krzyzewski said, "It was stupid, and it's because we live in a weird world, but I'd rather have it go on me than on Shire. I grew up Polish in Chicago. My father had to change his name to Cross instead of Krzyzewski so he could get work. People want to take a free shot. I understand that it comes with the territory. But even if the name on the uniform and all that goes with it was the same, this team was very different from the three previous Duke champions. The coach had been reborn, and the players were not good enough to win alone, so they had learned to win together." Krzyzewski sat on a folding chair in a small locker room at Lucas Oil Stadium a few minutes before midnight following last Saturday's 78-57 semifinal victory over West Virginia, his suit jacket removed but his tie still knotted. As a measure of his place in life, the next day, Easter Sunday, his seven grandchildren, aged 4 months to 10 years, would be conducting an egg hunt in his hotel suite. This team could have achieved what they have could not have achieved what they have because of one individual playing good, he said, or even two individuals. It's so great to have a five-guy team, and it's such a good feeling for me to be in their moment. It is a moment that actually began long before Indianapolis and far from Durham, North Carolina. In late October 2005, Krzyzewski was named coach of the U.S. Olympic team that would seek to restore the nation's basketball pride in Beijing. He was 58 and 4 years removed from his last NCAA title. "I was totally against him taking that job," says Mickey. I thought it was too much, but I was wrong. It turned out to be one of the best things he's ever done. It rejuvenated him. That latter-day dream team, the Redeem Team it was called, included Kobe Bryant, LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, and Carmelo Anthony, and emphatically returned the gold medal to the United States. It also gave Krzyzewski a learning experience they couldn't have found elsewhere. "Every player on that team is really smart," Krzyzewski said in Indianapolis before the Final Four semifinals. "Every assistant coach, Mike D'Antoni, Nate McMillan, and Jim Boeheim, is really smart. I learned so much, like how not to have complicated game plans or how to strategize certain situations. I learned to listen. I listen more to my own players now. And where else would I go to get that at this point in my career? A clinic? If there's a clinic, I'm probably giving the clinic." The world that Krzyzewski returned to at Duke in the fall of 2008 was more challenging than the one he left in Beijing. In the previous spring, the Blue Devils had been taken out in the second round by tough, overachieving West Virginia. Late in that game, Mountaineers guard Joe Mazzullo mocked the Duke tradition when he slapped the floor while playing defense. A year later, Duke fell again ignominiously in the Sweet 16, and Villanova scored 51 points in the second half of a 77-54 rout. While Nova players didn't woof, the result was embarrassment enough. "I'll never forget those games," Zubek says. "If you play your heart out, you have no regrets. But against West Virginia, we just got outfought. And against Villanova, we fell apart." The Blue Devils had not been to a Final Four in 5 years, the longest drought in Krzyzewski's tenure. Worse, they had become a finesse team, soft. But three things happened to propel them in another direction. Dynamic 6'4" junior guard Gerald Henderson left for the NBA. Sophomore guard Elliot Williams transferred to Memphis, and Zubek got healthy after 2 years of either missing games, 9 in 2007-2008, and one last year, or lacking strength and conditioning because of foot injuries. With the 6'8" Thomas and the 6'10" Plumlee brothers, Miles a sophomore and Mason a freshman, Duke shifted its emphasis from the outside to the inside. "We had to become a physical basketball team," says assistant coach Steve Ojahowski, who tutors the team's big men. "There was a time when Duke could generate easy baskets through turnovers with pressure. Now we have to do it with offensive rebounds." Zubek embodies the new Duke. Healthy for the first time since his freshman year, he lifted weights ferociously all summer to strengthen his lower body. He also shaved his head and grew a beard to project toughness, transforming his look from Glee to WWE. The facial hair, normally forbidden in the Duke program, prompted discussion at a fall team meeting. Coach said, "So what about the beard?" recalled Zubek. Then Wojo spoke up and said he liked it. And Coach went around and everybody said they liked it. Said it made me look tougher. So I could keep it, as long as I trimmed it clean. All year, Zubek was the leader in fierce practice sessions among the post players, most often in a three-man drill at which Wojciechowski throws a ball off the rim and three Duke bigs battle for the rebound until somebody controls it and scores on the other two. "And Wojo never blows the whistle," says Mason Plumlee, "never." Zubek made his first start of the season on February 13th for a home game against Maryland, and the Blue Devils went on to win 15 of their last 16 games. His increased presence helped create shooting and driving space for the 6'5 Shire, 18.2 points per game, the 6'8 Singler, 17.7, and the 6'2 Smith, 17.4. When Duke beat Baylor on March 28th to reach the Final Four, It was tough man Zubek who wept in the team's locker room at Reliant Stadium. Zubek's growth was on full display in the title game, as was Shires, who all season long fulfilled the career expectations heaped on him 4 years ago, although on his own terms. When he arrived in Durham, he was immediately compared to former Blue Devils star J.J. Redick, the 2006 Player of the Year. Krzyzewski saw another side. People wanted to call him a point guard, the coach said, but he's not a point guard. He's just a real unique player. He doesn't really have a position, but he's a beautiful kid. In 4 years, he never had a down day, never needed any maintenance. I never had him on the couch. Shire emerged from those 4 years mature and dangerous, shooting, slashing, and passing with equal efficiency. It took me a while to find myself as a college player, said Shire before the title game. People did expect me to be J.J. Redick, and I wasn't. I struggled a little bit. It's kind of crazy, this path I've been on, but I appreciate what it took to get here. It was appropriate that in order to reach the title game, Duke would have to beat the same program with some of the same players that so exposed the Blue Devils' lack of toughness 2 years before. In preparation for West Virginia, Krzyzewski and his assistant showed his players a 4-minute video of the Mountaineers' 77-62 loss to Purdue in West Lafayette, Indiana, on New Year's Day. Built in the image of Coach Bob Huggins, they had developed a reputation for toughness, but Purdue had pounded West Virginia into submission. Purdue played physical pressure defense, said Wojciechowski. We wanted to show our team what happens when you do that. What happened in Indianapolis was an unexpected blowout. Duke stretched an 8-point halftime lead to 14 midway through the second half and never allowed the Big East champions to make a run. And when the game was finally finished, Krzyzewski emptied his bench and brought his regulars to the sideline. They hugged and raised fists to the sky and then sat on the Duke bench, full of joy and celebration. Only then did Krzyzewski turn to his players and admonish them, and for a moment it was 1991 again. It was then, after the stunning victory over UNLV, that Krzyzewski had walked onto the floor, scowling, pushing his palms toward the floor to quell the celebration. It was a similar thought, said Krzyzewski later. You can't think about what you just did, even though you just did it, because there's one more game. And sometimes there is a little value in history after all. 48 hours later, the Duke players climbed atop the ceremonial platform on the floor of the stadium wearing gray championship T-shirts and blue hats. Confetti lay strewn around them. It is a place that Blue Devils have stood before, but this time is richer for its struggles and the drama of the season's final weekend. If this were a movie, Hayward's shot falls. Good thing this isn't a movie, said Shire. One team's fairy tale ends, another mission is fulfilled. Well, now let's go to college football, page 33. This article is entitled, A Texas Twist, and it has a picture right here on page 32 of one of the Texas players getting ready to throw a pass. The article continues, the Longhorns are going back under the center, and it could signal the beginning of the end for the spread. Mack Brown reached inside the aircraft carrier that passes for his desk last month and produced a legal pad. On the first page, the Texas coach drew an offensive formation that, if all goes according to plan, the Longhorns will use as their base for the 2010 season and could have a ripple effect far beyond Austin. With a few strokes of his pen, Brown diagrammed a formation, with a quarterback under center and a tailback directly behind him. Then explained that depending on the play, an H-back would line up either in the slot next to a tackle or as a traditional fullback, essentially a pro-style set used by many NFL teams, including the Colts, but one that had seemed in danger of extinction on the college level. The formation bears little resemblance to the ones Texas used for the past six seasons, with quarterbacks Vince Young and Colt McCoy pulling the trigger out of the shotgun spread. The Longhorns' change in philosophy is designed to kickstart a running attack that last season averaged 147.6 yards, Texas's worst since 2002. "We just keep getting further away from balance," says Brown, whose team ranked 61st in rushing but 22nd in passing in 2009. "We threw the ball so much that we lost our play-action pass, and that's your best way to get explosive plays downfield." The Texas transformation is a vote of no confidence in the spread, the trendy offense of the last decade. And with Florida, South Florida, and Texas Tech also tweaking their versions of that scheme to achieve better run-pass balance, the spread may have reached its peak. In their new offense, the Longhorns will put strong-arm sophomore Garrett Gilbert under center. For the crucial H-back position, the leading candidate is Barrett Matthews, a 6'2", 235-pound sophomore who arrived in Austin as a tight end and has the speed and size required to be a blocker and receiver. The formation will also demand different skills from the linemen who didn't excel at run blocking in the old system, which stressed zone blocking. You're coming off the ball and hitting people in the mouth instead of trying to zone and reach block them, says senior tackle Kyle Hicks. It's a lot more fun. The biggest beneficiaries should be Gilbert, who won't be forced to carry the team in his first year as the starter, and the running backs led by Trey Newton and Fozzie Whitaker, who will be building forward momentum unlike in the spread when they take handoffs. In Texas's unusual spring game on Sunday, the team demonstrated its emphasis on the ground game by running on its first 11 plays. The new look is a gamble, given that the Horns went 25-2 over the past 2 years. But if the switch succeeds, Texas might be the program that inspires the rest of the nation to put the shotgun spread back on the rack. Now let's go to golf. Inside Golf. This article is entitled Charm Offensive and has a picture of two golfers in the water. Yani Tseng, a bubbly 21-year-old with two majors on her resume, closes in on a frustrated Lorena Ochoa. Yani Tseng bought Annika Sorenstam's old house in Orlando, but their styles on a golf course couldn't be more distinct. If Sorenstam's stoic demeanor was the accompaniment to her greatness, Tseng plays golf with an ever-constant grin. "I just keep telling myself, commit to the shot and keep your tempo right and keep smiling all 18 holes," said Tseng, who on Sunday won the Kraft Nabisco Championship in Rancho Mirage, California, by a shot over Suzanne Pedersen to take her second major career. "I smile to the fans, to TV, to everyone here." Major championships are usually short on smiles, but the 21-year-old Tseng is gaining a reputation for being at her happiest and best in golf's toughest tournaments. Her first victory came 2 years ago during rookie season when she won the LPGA championship while showing off her flair for long drives and even bigger grins. Now Tseng, who is from Taiwan, is the latest golfer to take aim at Lorena Ochoa's tenuous hold as the number one player in the world. Ochoa finished fourth at the Kraft. While Tseng, who's now number two, and Ochoa have each won two majors, Ochoa of late has seemed as testy on the golf course as Tseng has been mirthful. On Sunday, Ochoa bogeyed the 13th hole, swiped at her skirt, and spiked her ball on the green so hard that she had to repair the ball mark. Ochoa's anger prompted CBS broadcaster and Hall of Famer Beth Daniel to say, "This is a reaction that we've seen from her that we did not see from her several years ago. She started to get so angry with herself and show that emotion." Ochoa, 28, talked before the tournament about the changes in her life and her future. Last year, she married Andres Conesa, the CEO of Aereo Mexico, and moved from Guadalajara to Mexico City. Conesa has three children from a previous relationship, and Ochoa has spoken of one day leaving golf to have children of her own. "My goal is to stay in that number one position as long as I play," Ochoa said. "And then just at a different stage for my life, I want to be home. I want to be with my husband. I want to do everyday things and be at one place, not traveling with a suitcase." Sorenstam, a 10-time major champion, retired at the end of 2008 at 38 and started a family. But she still has some ties to the tour. In January, when Singh was looking for help with her game, she called on Sorstam. My friend called her to see if she'd have time to talk with me because I felt like I was struggling. Singh said, she told me, everything outside the ropes you need to just get rid of. When you get inside the ropes, you just have to want to have fun and play golf, and you don't want to think about too much. With her length off the tee and comfort at the majors, Singh might be more like Sorenstam than anyone realizes. Now, how about finding out a little bit about horse racing? Page 39, article entitled Rosy Outlook. A dominant performance on the wood stamps, Escandera as the favorite for the Kentucky Derby. With just four favorites having won the Kentucky Derby since 1979, there's reason to be skeptical about the prospects of any three-year-old who goes into Louisville as the horse to beat. But after Escandera's romp in the Wood Memorial at Aqueduct last Saturday, it's going to be very hard to resist the hype that is sure to follow the colt to Louisville. The big chestnut, who completed one of the more dominating Derby prep campaigns in recent memory, hit the wire nine widening lengths in front of his nearest rival. The performance achieved without even the slightest urging from the jockey, John Velasquez, came 6 weeks after another nine furlong race, the Fountain of Youth at Gulfstream Park in Florida, which the horse won by eight lengths. Given that he will have an extra 220 yards to run at Churchill Downs on May 1st, Escandera, pronounced Escandrea, could win the run for the Roses by an even bigger margin. Think that's getting carried away? Perhaps. But it's hard not to dream big when you listen to Todd Fletcher. Fletcher, Escandrea's trainer and one of the more imperturbable characters in the sport of kings. It's amazing. The farther he goes, the better he gets, says Fletcher, who is 0-24 with his horses at the Derby, but could saddle a record 8 starters this year. The current best is 5. I've had some good prep wins, but none as impressive as these two. Trainer Nick Zito, whose colt Jackson Ben came home second to Escandrea in both the Wood and the Fountain of Youth, went Pletcher one better. A monster, said Zito of Escandrea after the race last Saturday. In a class by himself. I didn't think he'd run as good as he did in Florida, but he ran better. Bolstering the colt's credentials as the Derby favorite was the conclusive running of the Santa Anita Derby, a messy affair that saw two-year-old champion looking at Lucky endure a troubled trip to finish a game third, 6 lengths behind pace-setting winner Sydney's Candy. Lucky's jockey Garrett Gomez was criticized by trainer Bob Baffert for racing the colt into traffic along the rail on the turn for home, only to be forced to hit the brakes a few strides later. Baffert called the ride horrendous, but refused to say whether he planned to replace Gomez, who later punched the jockey, Victory Espinosa, whom he believed caused the incident. Gomez was fined $750 for the punch. The trip was a far cry from the squeaky clean ride given to Escandrea by Velasquez. He kept Esky off the trail and out of trouble down the back stretch, then gave the colt his head at the quarter pole. Velasquez kept looking back under his arm for rivals all the way to the wire. But nobody else threatened. It was a good feeling, said Velasquez. Afterward, he was just galloping all the way to Kentucky. Well, that's all we have time for today. Be sure to listen next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm John Ivey, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time.